Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Villa Together podcast with myself, Chris Ellis. Once again, I'm joined by Ian Gillett, and I'm delighted to welcome a very special guest today, which is ex-Aston Villa player, Brett Holman. Brett, how are you doing today?
I'm good, thanks. I think we were just discussing a little bit off air just then. I think we're doing a little bit better than you guys, unfortunately, but no, I'm doing great. So happy to be on this podcast with you boys.
Nice one, nice one. Much appreciated. Right, diving in, your time at Aston Villa. Yep. So obviously, you signed for us in 2012, signed free transfer. So it was agreed, I think, in the March of 2012. You were at AZ Alkmaar at the time. You'd had a reasonably successful time there, won the league with them, played Europa League. When it came to, obviously, you were at that point where your contract was coming towards an end with them. So obviously, you had opportunities to move on.
Yeah.
What was the key decision or decisions in for you deciding to come to Aston Villa?
I think obviously one was that little sort of Aussie sort of background, I suppose. When you look at Mark Bosnich when back in the day when he first went there, he had great memories there. You looked at the club and the history of the place. It said a lot. Huge club, massive club, big history. There was interested parties elsewhere. I know that West Ham was an interested party, even probably a year before with Avram Grant. At that moment, I had good chats with Alex McLeish, who was at that stage the manager. But it felt right. There was a good feeling and. I think the majority of the footballers in and around the world, the majority of the time we follow our gut and our feeling, and that feeling was great. I had a great feeling every time I went there for my first sort of tour around the massive training ground and the beautiful facilities, and I was like, yeah, this is the place I want to be.
Yeah, I think to be fair, I mean, obviously with us being fans, when we look at the training ground, when we look at the stadium, you look at it and you think, well, there's no place I'd rather be. So to play here, must be incredible. obviously, you mentioned Alex McLeish. Tell us about when you came to the club. I think it was your first day, possibly, and you bumped into Alex McLeish. Tell us about that story. Obviously, Alex McLeish.
It was harsh. It was harsh, I suppose. Welcome to England. But it wasn't. It wasn't. Look, I had great chats with him in March. I did my first medical, like you said, because you could sign on a free transfer after January because you had 6 months to go on your last contract with AZ. Everything went well. Medicals were fine. Finally, contract was finished with AZ, so I could get to move over and settle into Birmingham life, basically. I think it was my first day, or it was at least sort of like the end of the season when everything was getting sorted, so I could walk into the training ground, meet everybody, meet the chefs, meet the gear man, meet the assistants, and all that sort of stuff. And Alex McLeish was walking out with his box, and that was it, And it was a little bit scary at first because I was like, well, hold on, he was the one who signed me, sort of not knowing, obviously, the club signed me. But it was like, okay, where to from now? And he basically said, he wished me good luck. He was disappointed that he couldn't stay on because, he had a good passion and a massive drive to do well. Unfortunately, it didn't work out at Villa, but, that was probably a scary situation because I really felt that I was in limbo, even though it was probably one of the most exciting moves of my career, basically. So, it was a scary time in that little period before Paul Lambert came in.
Did you find it difficult in a way to go from this is, I suppose coming to England and you're expecting Alex McLeish and then the first manager you work under is Paul Lambert.
Yeah.
Did you find that difficult kind of, I say going between the two, I suppose you didn't really work under Alex McLeish, but I suppose he's the man who's putting the legwork to get you to Villa.
Correct.
And then obviously then you're working under Paul Lambert. Was that difficult to kind of work between?
I think it is. And I suppose it's a little bit of a different sort of type of method that happens in the UK where, the managers have got a lot of power, if they want a big signing or they want a big player and they want it, like you said, it does the legwork and you know, for me, I was lucky Alex McLeish liked me. So he was doing that legwork to get me to the club. It's a little bit hard when Paul Lambert sort of, you know, I wasn't on his radar. So it's always a little bit difficult, especially in the UK where, you know, the managers bring in players. Whereas in Europe, a lot of the time you've got a team of coach, sporting director, a general manager who make all the decisions. Whereas a little bit in the UK, it's sort of like that you've got, you know, it's getting more into that with technical directors and all that sort of stuff. But you usually see that the manager's got a big role to play in signing players. And I suppose when you see that the manager does sign you and then he walks out the door before you've even started, it's a little bit scary in regards to, oh, Jesus, the new manager might come in and it's like, yeah, I'm not having him anyway. And then you're going to be in trouble. So it was a little bit daunting. But yeah, on the other hand, I was there. So let's make the most of it.
Yeah, I think good point you mentioned about, you know, especially in the UK, the managers do have a lot of power. And I think, you know, we've seen it, obviously support Aston Villa for many years. We've seen it with all sorts of different players. You could have a group of players or, you know, a couple of players who have been potentially performing well. And It's just that overall the results aren't right. New manager comes in and then those players, for whatever reason, aren't fancied by the new manager. And that just seems to happen, you know, because They weren't the ones bringing them in. So obviously it kind of almost puts you on the back foot straight away, doesn't it? You know, in theory, because, you know, I suppose it'd be kind of like, you know, anyone in every, you know, day working, you go to an interview, you speak to somebody, they give you the job and you turn up and you're like, oh, who's this guy?
Yeah.
It's kind of, I suppose, daunting and it kind of puts extra added pressure on, doesn't it? So
it does. It does. You know, you walk in with a bit more confidence when you know that the manager is the one who brought you in. So you sort of walk in there with your chest up a little bit, and then all of a sudden that deflates really quick just because it's like, oh, you just got to keep your head down and almost sort of go unnoticed in a way, just to sort of get by and keep your spot, I suppose, in a certain area. I suppose if you look at it now, if you look at Dele Alli's situation,
is a
sort of a little example. Or, you know, obviously you still have to perform no matter what, but you know, under Pochettino, he was fantastic, and then you know, you see how it's sort of gone downhill a little bit. So it's you know, it does happen.
Yeah, definitely, 100%. Obviously he came in. I think it was actually your first game, your first preseason game. You scored another, so you had a relatively decent preseason. We had a relatively decent preseason overall. It comes into the season, we have a poor start, and I think overall the season itself was a pretty poor one. I think we were 5 points outside of the bottom three at the end of the season. There were some pretty low points during the season. We lost 8-0 against Chelsea. Knocked out by Bradford in the League Cup. Where we on paper, I suppose, looked like the favourites.
Should have win.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a tough one. Tough for us fans to take with those defeats like that. What about being part of the squad and the team at that time and the atmosphere? How kind of low were the team after those kind of defeats?
It was hard, I think. I suppose I'm going to compare it to the time when just before it, and that's what I was doing a lot when I was even at Villa, when the results weren't going down our way. If you look at sort of when you're in a winning side, if you put it like it, like you said, when we won the league with AZ in Holland, when you've got that camaraderie and you know, everybody's around and lifting each other up and stuff like that, it didn't feel like that around the training ground. It didn't feel like that. You know, match days, stuff like that. The only thing I sort of look back on and I sort of don't want to reflect on other people's performances, but it was like everybody was sort of battling with themselves a little bit. Where, you know, there weren't too many. If you look at it, like you said, we were 5 points off bottom three and, you know, there weren't too many standouts in that season anyway. We had a lot of great players, but you know, I don't think there'd be too many players who'd be putting their hands up saying, yeah, I think I deserve an above average for that season. And, you know, I don't think you can sort of fault the effort, because I think they, you know, every player wanted to give everything because they wanted the results. I think it was just one of those things where it was the group of players and it just didn't click. It was a new manager in who was trying to implement his sort of style that maybe needed some time. It could have been a whole lot of things, but yeah, to look back on it, it was really tough. It was a tough thing, especially coming from a team that was winning, you know, 80-90% of games in a season. Yeah, it was hard, but you know, on the other hand, it was definitely something that I liked, because it's a great challenge to have and to fight for. But like I said, we were in a tough spot the whole year. You know, there was, you know, we had some great results as well. When you go to Liverpool away and win 3-0, I think it was, and you know, you had some cracking results, but then you had some bloody absolute disastrous results as well. And I think we had, you know, too many bad performances than good ones in that year.
Yeah, I mean, I think in all fairness, I think, like you say, it was probably a combination of things. New manager comes in. I think, obviously, when looking in at it for us guys, there was a lot of changes. Like, we went from, you know, we had Martin O'Neill to Gerard Houllier to Alex McLeish. Yeah. Paul Lambert comes in. And going from beforehand, we were spending a lot of money. And then under Paul Lambert, it was like he was given a different, you know, a different kind of strategy. It was like, well, you need to not spend as much money.
Yeah,
and obviously it showed that eventually, I know it wasn't under Paul Lambert, but it showed eventually that kind of things weren't working when we got relegated. And
yes,
those few years were tough. So obviously for you, yep, being part of that, as you say, you're going for a winning side in Holland. You come to a side that we were for three or four seasons treading water just to stay above,
yeah,
relegation. So obviously for you coming in and being part of that, you know, just adds to the kind of the difficulties of not only moving to a new club, but also moving to a completely, you know, different country.
Yeah, different environment, different, even, you know, you can say it's still Europe, but even just a way of, you know, going about things, you know, the Dutch are very, you know, over-analyzing everything, you know, a lot of team meetings, a lot of tactics. Whereas, you know, the UK stuff, it wasn't like that, or especially what we experienced. You could probably ask Ron Flaher and Kareem El Amadi, because we sort of came the same year anyway.
Yeah.
And we sort of experienced that same sort of type of thing. And like you said as well, it was at that stage where you know, it was in the press. Paul Lambert wasn't given the amount of money that you know, those, you know, if you call them those so-called, you know, higher, you know, well-known managers back in the day. But, you know, on the other hand, if you look at it, it was that period where, you know, you probably had to be a little bit smarter. You know, Martin O'Neill spent a lot of money. You know, these are the type of things where you can't just keep spending money if it's not getting any better anyway. Of course, you know, Martin O'Neill did get some cracking results. But, you know, like you said, in that 4 or 5 period, it wasn't great. And I think, yeah, I suppose it wasn't nice to play in the championship either. But if you look at it, it was probably a blessing anyway, because it sort of put things really back into reality to say, hey, you can't just keep spending money and giving out, you know, these monstrous wages and not see anything back, really. Yeah, I think if you look at it in hindsight, it was probably a good thing that it actually happened.
No, totally agree.
So, Brett, in regards to that season, obviously we've gone over a few of the low points, and you did mention a few notable highs with the Liverpool game. There's also probably the quarterfinal away leg at Norwich, where you had a big, yep, part to play in that result. Just talk us through that Liverpool game to start with. Away at Anfield, very much the underdogs, not having a great season, very inconsistent. But just talk about that win and how it sort of may have galvanised the squad.
It was, you know what? It's one of those games where it should really lift you for a certain period after that, after such a win against such a side in such a place. I was actually speaking to a couple of friends of mine recently about that game, where when I think it would have been the first 20 minutes, I don't think we even touched the ball. There would have been about, you know, if you ask the Bladders who were actually on the field, it felt like there was probably about 20 Liverpool jerseys on the field at that moment, because they just come out of the gate so fast. You know, you got Steven Gerrard and Luis Suarez just going absolutely bonkers. But, you know, that win when, you know, Benteke scores, I think Andy Wyman gets one as well, or a double. I'm not quite sure who gets two. And it should, like I said, it should lift you for for you know, that next sort of period on in such a huge win. You know, the dressing room after was absolutely fantastic. It was you know, the spirits were up. It was a huge result. Still got a nice little scar from Joel Cole, who gave me a nice little stud mark, you know, almost knee high. So that was a nice little wall mark. But you know, it was a great experience, and you know, those are the games that, like you said, they're the ones you remember. You know, you play at Anfield away, you know, you hear the song, and then you know, the home team sort of walks into the tunnel with their tails between their legs with 3-0, and you know, you've got an absolutely fantastic feeling.
Yeah, definitely. It was a great result, and one that we very much remember as Villa fans. In terms of that, like, you talk about that squad that we had at the time, there was quite a few sort of young players, the likes of Albrighton, Barry Bannon, Nathan Baker as well. I think I remember that day, Nathan Baker having an absolute worldie of a game. He was on the end of everything in the air, and blocks here, there and everywhere. They had a very young Raheem Sterling playing for them that at the time was just coming into sort of that form that we now recognise with him consistently. So yeah, it was a massive win. In terms of that season as well, what was it like scoring your first goal in the away game at QPR at Loftus Road?
It was sort of a weight off my shoulders. I think that's with every player who comes to a new club and you know, gets their first official goal for their club. Weight off my shoulders. We were still in it. You know, we were, that whole season we were in a bit of a tough area. So you know, I think we went one. I think I scored 1-0 up, and we unfortunately drew 1-1. I think it was a QPR that day, but it was a great. It was a great feeling to actually score my first goal for the club. You know, if you know, asking about scoring, the only regret was not scoring at the Holt end. You know, for my career, you know, in one of those whole things, to actually celebrate in front of those fantastic fans, that was probably one of those things that still eats away at me in a way. But you know, it was a great feeling, and yeah, scoring in the Premier League was a dream for me anyway. So it was something that came true.
Yeah, definitely such a great moment for yourself. What do you think it was in terms of the structure of the team and the way we were coached that season, where we did have a few notable highs, but there was a lot of lows as well? Where do you think the sort of inconsistencies lay with us and that team? Was it just for the nature of how the squad, how it was made up with the younger players as well, or? Was there something?
I think it was. I think there could be a combination. You know, and I think if I knew that, you could put your finger on it, and we could have changed it somehow. But there was a combination of everything: new manager, new players, foreign players, younger players, older players who weren't maybe performing as much. The manager who maybe wanted certain players off the wage bill as well at that stage. You know, there were so many different things that you could put it down to, and obviously if those things don't all come into one, or you know, they don't happen at the same time, put it that way. If the manager wants players who he doesn't see fit in his sort of system and his sort of vision, it's hard to just push them on, you know, because if players are on certain wages, they can't just, you know, say rock up, we're going to go to another club. It doesn't work like that. So I think it was difficult. Especially for a manager like you know, coming in and you know, trying to implement something, but maybe not having the means or maybe the backing as well, I suppose, in a certain extent. And also, like I said, I don't think there was too many overachievers that year. I think there was a lot of performances where, you know, a lot of players battled with themselves to really perform and stand out and push the team on. So. It was just a really, really hard season.
Yeah, definitely was. I mean, in terms of that start of that season, there was a lot of goodwill towards Paul Lambert and the style of football that he had previously played at Norwich. I remember going to the Norwich away game the season before you joined, and all the Villa fans were chanting when he was the Norwich manager for him to come and manage Aston Villa the following season, which it happened. So there was quite a few false dawns under Lambert. And I suppose football, you can put it down to certain moments and certain big moments, and probably for us to go out in the semi-final against Bradford in the League Cup that season. Whereas if we win that game, we get to a final, we potentially win a final, and it's a very different story for sort of Lambert and his tenure. So before we move on, just sum up your time at Aston Villa with a few words for us.
It was short. It was definitely short. It was a dream come true. It was definitely a dream come true. It was something that I always wanted to experience, and I'll never forget the club, the people who work there, and you know, the lifetimers there who spend their whole life and they dedicate their whole life to such a fantastic club. I enjoyed it thoroughly. Unfortunately, it was one of those things that just didn't work out for me. But I still follow the Villa now. And still go for them when they're playing games. And when they were in that tough time in the championship, I was still hoping when they were winning games and when Milan Jedinak was there and following him and hopefully, getting them back into the Prem. But, one of the greatest experience that I'll ever experience. And like I said, a dream come true to play in the Premier League and for such a fantastic club.
Was it?
Yeah.
What about when you left? Was that because that season I think you played 29 times overall. So you played a good chunk of that season.
Yeah.
Was it a case that you felt you hadn't settled at the club and you wanted to move on, or because you weren't a kind of a Paul Lambert signing that?
No,
it was kind of a bit of both, so to speak.
It could have been a bit of both. Look, I had a frank chat. Honestly, there was a frank chat with the manager straight after the end of the season, and basically putting it into the words where I wasn't one of his signings. And the bottom line was that I'd be very rarely used the next coming seasons. I honestly said to him, I still do have a contract, and Aston Villa gave me that contract for 3 seasons. So I'm gonna try and have a dig if possible. But if you're basically saying I'm not gonna play, then I suppose it's a good thing to look elsewhere, which we did. And I think in the end, when you get that sort of message that it wasn't in those sort of words where you're not wanted, but that's how it came across. Then. I think it's better for both parties to move on in that sense and shake hands and go each other's ways.
I mean, it's almost like football in a nutshell, isn't it? The kind of, I suppose, the bad side to football in terms of you sign for a club, massive move for you in your career, and then you turn up and the manager who signed you has moved on, and it's kind of, it kind of always puts you on the back foot straight away, doesn't it?
It is. And you know what? I gave everything and that pre-season, I don't think I've never worked so hard in my entire life, because I knew, I had to do double as much because the manager didn't bring me in, basically. I tried to prove to him that, I was worthy of those games that he played me in. And, like I said, unfortunately, I didn't score enough or assist enough. And I think we were in that sort of team that didn't help either, where, you couldn't perform it was just everybody was struggling with themselves. And it was one of those things where it just didn't click. And you can't put it down to anybody. That's just, like you said, that's football in a nutshell. Yeah. You just acknowledge it, I suppose, in a way, and move on and create another path, basically.
What about then, just before we kind of almost go back to the start of your time in Holland, what about leaving Aston Villa then? You ended up in Dubai. What was that move like? Because I suppose moving to a country where, I know football is, obviously it's getting bigger now and all that kind of stuff, but obviously at the time where football in Dubai wasn't necessarily a big thing, whereas you've come from Holland and England to,
Premier League,
Exactly.
No, do you know what? I don't regret moving there at all. I do regret maybe not holding out for maybe another Premier League club or another club in England. That was the only thing, maybe, if you really look at it in hindsight. But on the other hand, I don't regret moving to you know, the, what is it, the UAE. The experiences that me and my family had there were memorable. And, you know, like you said, the football is completely different. It's so hard because it's so hot. You know, there's only three or four foreign players, which creates that extra pressure because you always have to perform because you are the foreign players. So, you know, there's all different types of things to I suppose, you know, add that sort of pressure. It's not the pressure of you know, playing for 40,000, you know, players at Villa Park, but it's a different pressure that, you know, you have to put on yourself to perform every single week. Because, you know, there are fans there who love their clubs as well, but it's just not as you know, big and popular and as fanatical as it is in the UK and in Europe. It's probably as simple as that.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of them. You know, going to UAE and Dubai, it's kind of got its different experiences, hasn't it? In terms of going there, because Dubai is such an amazing place.
Yeah,
I suppose as well, you know, taking you and your family into consideration, that was a you know, an amazing experience for all you guys.
I think it was more, you know, my wife's Dutch, so you know, I was in Holland for 11 years. I went to the UK. Obviously, it was only 1 year when we envisaged it to be you know, a lot longer. But then I thought to myself, I don't want to go back to Holland because, you know, obviously that's where I built my name up. Could I have gone to Europe somewhere else maybe and tried your luck in a Germany or in Italy or something like that? But then I thought, you know, this popped up. Let's you know, do the 180 or the 360, whichever way you want to call it, and try something completely, you know, out of you know, this, you know, sort of picture, I suppose, in regards to getting out of Europe and try something completely different. And that's what we did. And, you know, we ended up staying there for 3 years and yeah, it was fantastic.
What about then? We'll go back to the kind of the start in terms of your football career in Europe. What was that like moving from Australia to Holland when it first was tough.
It was hard, obviously, because I left so young. That was probably the toughest part. The greatest thing that I had was, you know, there was a couple of other older Aussies who were just slowly paving the way in Holland. Brett Emmerton was there at Feyenoord. Jason Kalina was at Ajax, who ended up playing at PSV. So there was a couple of names who already sort of made, you know, sort of paved the way for the Aussies, you know. So it probably made it a little bit easier, put it that way, because Brett Emmerton was performing really well. They won the what did they win? They won the Europa League, the Europa Cup against Borussia Dortmund and stuff like that. Went to Feyenoord, had a great tournament. They gave me a contract, and you know, it was hard because I was only 17 and you know, going, you know, the other side of the world without mum and dad and you know, learning how to cook and clean and all that sort of crap, and you know, it was daunting, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because you know you learn to grow up real quick and be a man, because otherwise if you don't, you're going to sink pretty quick and you're going to go home between with your tail between your legs, and you know, that was something that I didn't want happen to me. So it was grow up real quick.
Obviously, you know, like you say, playing at Feyenoord, I suppose you kind of, your success would have been at AZ Alkmaar.
Yeah.
Like we said earlier, winning the league, playing in the Europa League. What was that experience like of being part of a title winning side in, you know, a big league like the Eredivisie?
Yeah, look, if you look at it now, there'll be debates in regards to, you know, UK's a big league, the Serie A is a big league. You probably look at the Bundesliga maybe in that tier as well. And then you probably, you know, maybe even France. And then you go below where you look at your Dutch and your Belgians and that sort of stuff. But I suppose if you look at that top three of Feyenoord, PSV and Ajax, and for us as AZ to actually break the trend and you know, it wasn't a miracle and it wasn't a Leicester City sort of type of championship, but it was a really, really big deal, because, you know, PSV, or, you know, you're talking about the big boys with Matteo Kesman, Van Bommel, you know, Andre Oya, these sort of bigger players. Ajax, who we played with, you know, that was before when we won, who were developing Snyder, Van der Vaart, Ibrahimovic, Mido, you know, big clubs. And I think at AZ to you know, like I said, break that top three was an absolutely huge achievement. And yeah, you know, they were 4 years that I spent there was probably my best time career wise, playing wise, performing wise. That was probably my best period.
About playing European football, you know, Europa League with AZ, you know, what was that like as an experience? Obviously, you know, moving all over the place, going to different countries, etc.
Massive experience. We played the Champions League once straight after obviously winning the league.
Yep.
I've had a crappy group stage. I think we drew with Arsenal at home and absolutely got smashed at Emirates. Went to Olympiacos and had Standard Liège. But, you know, the experience was like, you know, going back to Europa League. Europa League was absolutely fantastic. We made the quarterfinals once, which was fantastic, and played Valencia. You know, we played some, you know, big sides, and I suppose that put me in good stead, especially travelling a lot, and it helped me a lot, especially when I started getting picked for the national team. You know, that travelling and learning how to take care of your body and focus on the game one after another, and you're playing three times a week. It helped me a lot to really understand how you had to take care of your body and you know, be a little bit selfish and say, look, I can't do this. I have to put my feet up and just take it easy.
We mentioned earlier about when you were at Villa and the managerial change. What about the kind of managerial changes you went through while in Holland? Because obviously there were some interesting managers that you played under.
Yeah, cracking characters. Louis van Gaal was an absolute genius, I would almost say, in regards to just the football. You know, he was such a hard man to communicate with. He was so passionate about his football. It was you know, everybody knows him at Man United, that the you know, the crazy Dutchman, I think it was one of them. But you know, it was because he was so passionate about it that you know, he took himself over the edge a lot of the times, where, you know, he didn't know how to express himself. But, you know, he was probably the only manager that I ever experienced that he would come in at halftime and actually tweak things in our formation and maybe sub players, and he'd win us the game. And it would, you know, players would look and just say, wait, this guy's having one. When you know, he would change things at halftime, but he would actually win us the game. Huge. And he was the one who actually signed me from my old club at NEC. So, you know, that was just a big thing for me. You know, manager of Ajax, won the you know, UEFA Champions League, went to Barcelona. You know, just a huge icon, I suppose, of Dutch football in that stage. And, you know, he went. Ronald Koeman came after that. That was another, you know, small name, but unfortunately he got the sack real quick. Results didn't go our way. It was just a little bit of a crappy period, and I think it was probably a good experience for Ronald at that time because he sort of let us do things what we wanted to do in regards to, we won the league, he came in and he thought, okay, we'll just keep that going. And I think he needed to be a little bit tougher on us, and I think he learned from that. So he was brilliant. And then, you know, the little general Dick Advocaat, he came in as well, and he was just the best motivator that I've ever experienced. You know, he would have players, mate, eating nails, you know, before the game, just how well he could motivate people. You know, you'd run through walls for him, so that time, you know, Zed and the managers that I had, it was not a bad list, that's for sure.
I was going to say, you know, you look at kind of top managers from Holland and stuff like that, and those three would be certainly towards the top. So, you know, what an experience to have played under those three. Also, obviously, you ended your career at Brisbane Roar.
Yep.
Was that something in your mind that, you know, that you wanted to end your career in Australia, or was it just an opportunity came about?
Yeah, no. There was no there was no course set. There was no plan set. Craig Moore and John Aloisi, who were at Brisbane Roar, and players I played with the national team were there. Craig Moore was the technical director at that stage, and John Aloisi was the manager. Had a quick chat with him. I was still in Holland because after I finished with my last club in the UAE, we flew back. We went and stayed in Holland where we still had a place. And we were just in Holland and I sort of, yeah, there was no real path. There was no real course. Had a good chat with him and we just said, let's go and have a crack and moved back to Brisbane and you know, not even where I was born. You know, I was born in Sydney. So moved to Brisbane and I suppose, yeah, we enjoyed it and you know, haven't moved since sort of type thing. We've moved north, but yeah, we enjoyed it. We enjoy our time here.
And obviously, aside from the club football, as you touched on, you played for the Australia national side.
Yeah.
Talk us about you kind of the early days of that and you getting your first call-ups and that kind of stuff and your feelings and emotions of kind of when you're first getting told that you're going to play for the Australian national side.
I suppose, yes, you're excited. But then I was also like a little bit scared in a way to say, shit, I'm going to be in the same bus with Harry Kuehl, Mark Viduka, Mark Schwarzer. I think Mark Bosnich was almost finishing then at that time. Tony Popovich was there. And then I was like, yeah, this is pretty scary. You know, a young lad and these guys are huge names scoring in Champions Leagues. I remember watching Mark Viduka score that beautiful hat-trick against Liverpool and you know, Harry Kuehl scoring worldies against Arsenal. And then I'm like, yeah, I'm in a bit of trouble here. I just got to keep my head down as soon as I get on that bus and sort of almost go unnoticed in a way. I was super excited and super proud to have, you know, been called up and yeah, I suppose, you know, I keep saying dreams come true. You know, I think one of my biggest dreams was the first things that we used to see on television was on Fox Sports and that was the Premier League. And it was Mark Viduka and Harry Kuehl at Leeds, and they were probably the ones I followed the most. And you know, there was other boys playing, you know, paving the way, and Lucas Neal and these sort of lads. But those were the two that I always looked up to in a certain aspect. And you know, to finally play in the Premier League, that was sort of the big dream. You know, and you know, to play for your country, it's just a massive honour, just a huge honour.
And obviously, 2010, the World Cup. Not only did you play for Australia in the World Cup, but you scored against Serbia in the 2010 yeah. World Cup. Again, yeah. You know, what's that like? You know, not only playing in the World Cup, but scoring in the World Cup.
Yeah, no, like you said, give me a minute. Give me a minute in a World Cup and I would have been happy, I think. You know what I mean? Yeah. Just get me on there. And I was lucky enough to have a fantastic manager who unfortunately passed away, Pim Verbeek. He had so much confidence in myself where, you know, for some reason he'd just say a couple of words and you know, he'd give me that, I don't know, just that freedom, that type of freedom feeling just to go out there and just try anything. And you know, even my old man, you know, used to always say, go out and have a dig and you know, you'll never find out if you don't try. And, you know, I don't think I'd ever have a shot like I took it at Serbia with 30 yards out. I'd probably never do it again. but you know, it was one of those moments where I suppose everything clicked. The manager saying, you know, giving you that sort of type of freedom. Your old man always saying, you know, go out and have a crack. And you know, I suppose all rolled into one and you know, doing it on that stage at that moment, you know, it was just, yeah, bloody euphoric, basically, and yeah, amazing.
Yeah, I think anybody, like you say, have 1 minute in a World Cup, you know, would be incredible. And obviously, for you to kind of represent your country is amazing. I think another thing as well is that when you think about it, it's, you know, for anybody, like you look at, say, the England team, for example, now, and a player like Jack Grealish, you know, kind of not necessarily struggling, but not playing for England as much as he would have liked to have done in the early days, sure. so to speak. You know, you kind of look at the case for you. You look at the attacking players that Australia had: Viduka, Kuehl, Mark Bresciano, you know, Tim Cahill, stuff like that. So again, it kind of shows, you know, you're competing with these guys, you get into the side, you know, and you kind of, you know, it reflects how well you've done to get into the national side and also to go to a World Cup. So, you know, to do that, like you say, to have 1 minute in the World Cup would be incredible. Obviously, to do that, like what you've done, obviously must be kind of up there, as you say, with playing in the Premier League.
Exactly. No, but you said it perfectly. If you talk about certain moments, you know, Champions League, Premier League, scoring your first goal, scoring in a World Cup, those moments, you know, just say, yeah, you have to pick one. I think you'd always pick a World Cup just because it was the strike and the moment. Mum and dad were there. My wife was there. You know, all that sort of stuff. It would have been that moment. But, you know, there are moments in your career where you would always, they remain so fondly they'll sort of remain, I think, because that was such a highlight.
That was it 2010 World Cup? Was that South Africa?
Yep.
What was that like being in South Africa? Because you could, you know, watching the games, I mean, it's one part of it, but watching the games, you could hear the crowd and the vuvuzelas and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It just seemed to be, you know, such a, you know, great place to be, you know, not just for football, but for everything in general. So for you traveling there with Australia, what was that like?
It was brilliant. I think, they put that big emphasis on security, given the fact that being in South Africa and such a world event, you know, they didn't want anything to happen. Yeah. So, the security was high, but the people, everybody, you know, so excited just to have such a massive event, probably the biggest events in the world, to be there. Everybody was friendly. You know, even, you know, you talk about, you know, the supporters, I suppose, more than anything, you know, such harmony in the stands, you know what I mean? Nice and friendly, countries walking in and between each other. That's what you want to see at football games. And you know, you go on Barrack and cheer for your team, win or lose. You know, you go and have a beer afterwards and you chat about it and you enjoy it. I suppose that's how I experienced it in a way. We were a little bit secluded, I suppose, because it was that, you know, security sort of type of thing where you had to be a little bit distance and away from everybody once you were in camp. But, you know, the experience was amazing. The country's beautiful. Stadiums were phenomenal and the crowds were brilliant. So, I can only, you know, give my feeling and how I felt there. You know, you hear stories about 2006 in Germany, how brilliant it was, and obviously the 2014 in Brazil and stuff like that. But, you know, I had a fantastic experience.
Amazing. Just before we move on to the last bit, there's one kind of question I want to ask you about, which is kind of topical at the moment, so to speak, is VAR. And VAR, you know, VAR, especially, you know, for us guys with it coming into the Premier League and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's like a double-edged question, so to speak. The first one is kind of what your thoughts on VAR. And the second one is, you know, if you were playing, you know, would you like VAR to be around or not?
Actually, we had it just before I finished. They started bringing it in. I think Australia was one of the first countries who actually started with the VAR. And, you know what, I like it. I do like it in regards to certain decisions and you know, especially when players are trying to you know, you'd almost say cheat the referee, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah.
In certain aspects. I like it when the VAR can play that. But I don't like, I honestly love and I would probably say the Premier League. Only the Premier League, maybe, in that certain aspect. I love it because it's fast, it's furious, it doesn't stop, it goes. And then when you've got the VAR and you've got referees running to sidelines and it takes forever and everybody's standing around, it defeats the purpose of it. And you lose that interaction and you lose that. You know, there's definitely times that I've experienced where it has happened with the VAR and I'm watching a game and it takes forever and players are standing around that I even just walk away. I've missed the rest of the game. Just purely for that fact, because it just takes forever. I think if they can somehow, you know, do those things quicker, and find a way to fix that and find solutions for that. I think it's a good thing to have, definitely.
Yeah, I think the point you make about the, you know, the pace and all that kind of stuff, and I suppose the wait for decisions, is probably, you know, a big thing that kind of annoys fans, because you kind of sat there and you're like, how's it taking so long to make that decision? Yeah. And it goes back.
Sees it. Yeah. We all see it, you know.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to what they say about, you know, it clear and obvious error. Well, if it's clear and obvious, then they shouldn't spend that long looking at it. They should look and say, if they can't see it within the first 10, 15 seconds, then, you know, there you go, done, play on.
It's a hard one, I suppose. If you're sorry to butt in, it's a hard one, I suppose, in regards to, you're almost sort of saying, well, why do you actually need a referee, really?
Yeah,
you know, you could almost have somebody in on the sidelines blowing a whistle, because you could almost blow every single thing up and say, okay, you missed that. And, you know, it's a little bit, it's so hard to actually find the happy medium with this technology. And rules, it's too hard, I think, and it's too much at stake at the moment to just keep saying it's going to be trial and error when you know people and teams are getting disadvantaged, and I think that's the huge problem at the moment.
Yeah, 100%. I mean,
it seems like in England we've started micromanaging games, and sort of the interference that VAR is having is becoming too involved, rather than, like Chris said, the sort of, if it is a clear error, it's a clear error. But if it's marginal and we can't see it with one or two runs of the replay, then we just play on. We've seen a few with Villa with the offsides where they've had to show the clip, and it's probably taken about 4 or 5 minutes, and it's like a nostril hair or an armpit offside.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, you know. And that's the charm of the game, where you always gave the benefit of the doubt to the striker. You know, that was the charm of football, and you know, he made a fantastic run, and exactly what you said, it's a fingernail, I think that's ridiculous, it was always like that. It's the cricket as well. It's the same, I suppose, with all the technology. If you really look at it, it was, you know, with LBW and stuff, it was the benefit of the doubt. You gave the benefit of the doubt to the batsman, and it's the same with the strikers. You know, he made a fantastic run. You give the benefit to the striker, and it's play on. So it's a very hard discussion at the moment, and I don't think it's going to get solved anytime soon, unfortunately.
Did you have experience of, because I noticed in the A-League, they did do the trial with miking up the referees and letting everybody hear what the referees were discussing at the time. And I think one of the referees,
Jared. Jared, UK.
Shares the same surname with myself.
Well, there wasn't too much of that. I think it was more, I don't even know if it was for purely for a ruling and a referee's thing. I think that was more a commercial type of thing at that stage, just to have it on the TV and give it for a referee's point of view, where actually the supporters can hear what's going on through a referee's sort of vision, basically. That was my understanding of it, because it wasn't around long here.
Yeah, because I remember watching that. There was, I can't think who was playing, but I remember Jared Gillett was the ref, and he was mic'd up, and every decision, you heard the other side of the VAR, you know, the VAR were getting in touch with him saying, you might want to look at that, and then he'd go over and have a look, and then you could hear the conversations he was having with the captains and stuff like that, and I thought, that's quite good. Whether that's something that we'd want to see in England or not, I don't know. I don't know how much. Whether it makes any difference, or I suppose in theory, it's just looking at accountability, isn't it? You make a referee accountable for the decisions there.
Well, then I suppose you go back and well, like I said, you go back and you say, well, you know, do we need a referee? Basically, every single decision is getting pulled up, or somebody speaking in his ear saying, oh, you've missed that, or you've missed that, and then I was like, that's the charm of it, I suppose, in a way. That's the charm of football. You know, everybody makes mistakes. People miss penalties, you know, and you know, that's what it is. And you know, unfortunately, you know, referees, it's a really hard job, but you know, they do make mistakes, but you know, that's the fun of it as well.
Yeah. 100%. 100%.
Yeah, definitely. You've almost got to bring in an element now of your structure on the training ground is regarding how you prepare for VAR and making sure that you are match savvy. And if you're on a yellow card nowadays in the Premier League, you cannot make a second challenge because you know you're going to be straight off. It's going to be the red card's going to be straight out of that pocket as soon as you make that second challenge. So it's almost like you've got to talk to your players and structure your training sessions around managing that VAR and making sure you are savvy enough to get around it.
Completely. Yeah, you're correct. It is that because, like you said, you would always have those players back in the day where even if they're on a yellow, then you know, they could do something cheeky off the ball or whatever because it was down the other end of the field and nobody was watching. But these days, all that stuff's getting pulled up. So it's, it is that. And I suppose that's almost the job for the managers because it's, like you said, these things have to start, you almost have to train them really because it these things will happen and you do have hot-headed players. So, it's one of those things where you'll have to, make players aware because everything that happens now is it's going to get found out, basically.
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt.
Yeah.
So before we let you go and enjoy what's left of your evening in Oz, we're just going to do a few quick fire questions at you. And like with anything we quick fire, just say the first thing that comes to your head. Some of the we've gone over in some of the topics already, so you'll have a sort of good idea of what you're going to say anyway. So the first one is best manager you have ever played under?
Pim Verbeek. Definitely. To give a smaller description, everything he did with me, he gave me wings. He gave me wings. Small little words, even just an arm over me, an arm over my shoulder, something like that, something tiny. It was enough to just get me, just hungry for more every single time and huge part of my life and even outside of football and inside, he was, definitely Pim.
Love it. Yeah, like you say, with a career like you've had when you've moved sort of from Australia across to the other side of the world to Europe and then sort of to England briefly and then out to the UAA, it's like those sort of characters and those people that help mold you as a person and sort of develop you and sort of the values and beliefs that you get from sort of being guided by them, I suppose.
Exactly right. And exactly that, just sort of, values after football. Like you said, they were things, and there was definitely managers who wanted to instill that as well. It wasn't just only about the ball. It was like you said, it was after football and things you needed to think about, and whatever you go into after football, you've got those good values of never giving up and always giving 100% and working hard and stuff like that. So that is true.
Good stuff. Second one, best player you've ever played with?
Harry Kewell. Harry Kewell was the best player I've ever played with. If I had to say another one, and he wasn't Aussie, then I'd probably say Moussa Dembele. He was at AZ and obviously at Tottenham. You guys would know.
What a player he was!
Yeah, Harry was bloody hell. Yeah, just. Yeah, unbelievable. He was just magic. I was in awe of him in certain aspects. Every time he would do something with the ball, and you understand why he was at such great clubs. And unfortunately, he had that bloody tough run at Liverpool. But some of the things he did at Leeds in his younger days, and even at Liverpool, some of the goals he scored. He was a great player. And Moussa, you couldn't even get the ball off him. You couldn't get the ball off him at training. He was just so strong and it was unfortunate. He moved to China. I honestly could have felt that after Tottenham, he could have went somewhere huge. He could have went to a Barcelona or a Madrid, hands down, and in my eyes. I went to Dubai. Moussa went to China. It was, it's certain decisions that people make and that's their good right. So,
Yeah, everybody's got their different journey, haven't they? And I suppose when you look back at it, you can't have any regrets, because these sort of the moves they do sort of help you progress as a person, not just on a football field, but as a person and sort of your family life as well, and the cultural learnings that you potentially have from those kind of moves.
Exactly.
So the next one, although it was a short one season period at Aston Villa, who was your favourite player of that time when you were playing at Villa?
When I was playing with the players who I was playing with, good question, mate. Good question. I'm going to think long and hard about this one. There weren't too many good performers in that season, so I'd probably say Fabian Delph. If I looked at the stuff that he used to do on the training pitch, the effort that he used to put in, he was just such a hard worker, and at a young age as well, and you know, he was brilliant. Yeah, I couldn't probably go past anybody else. I suppose Delphi was would probably be my pick for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose there's a lot of bad sort of well between Villa fans and Fabian Delph in the way that he left us after saying he was going to stay when he moved to Man City. But yeah, you did see that sort of when he stayed fit and he was on that football field, and you saw that determination and motivation he had to improve himself as a player and sort of drag the rest of the team with him. You can't fault that sort of attitude.
But that's why he was one of those players at such a young age where he was even trying to demand more from other players, and he would try and show that, whether it was in the recovery sessions, in the gym, on the pitch. He was great in that, and I did follow that saga, and it was unfortunate how it developed, and because I think he really did some good stuff at Villa, and he did give it all every time he went on that pitch, and yeah, unfortunately, in the football world, things happen and players make transfers. But I know that he did give everything for Villa when he did play, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. That's good to hear. So your favourite goal you've ever scored, and probably I think I've got maybe an idea of what you may say here, but go ahead.
It's done. We've already spoken about it. It was at the World Cup. It was against Serbia. It's everything. It's everything around it, the moment, the timing. Like I said, I probably would never have tried, from that range ever again in my whole life. And like I said, that my pre-season leading up to the camp that I had, I was flying. I felt great. I was ready to go. And everything just worked. It clicked. And that's how I suppose that goal eventuated. So, such a great moment for me.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, your dad said, if you don't have a dig, you don't know what could happen. So, yeah, great. Correct. Great moment for you and your family, and obviously the whole nation in Australia at the time scoring that goal. Next question. Your best friend in football, in the football community?
Best friend. Wow. I've got a few. There's probably two who I've got really good relationships with. One is Gilles Zouets. He's a Belgium player, Belgium international. I played with him my first years at Excelsior when I went to Feyenoord. And then we actually transferred from different clubs to AZ at the same time and played three seasons there. He lives in Belgium now. He's actually the under-23s coach at FC Antwerp. I've still got fantastic contact with him, and we sort of grew up together. So he was one of them. Another close mate would be Carl Valeri. We were roomies forever with the national team, and he played in Italy for 10 years. Went back home, and I think he's a players liaison at Melbourne Victory in one of the A League clubs. But those two are probably my best sort of mates in the football scene.
Excellent. Great. Great to hear. And then the final one before we move on to the last part of the interview, your best memory in football, and you probably already mentioned it, but yeah, go ahead.
Best memory. You know what? You know, I've already given the World Cup a bit of a rap. So I would probably, it's too hard. It's too hard to sort of choose between the Premier League and the Champions League song. Going out and walking out for the first time and starting one of the games and listening to the Champions League song was something really special. You know, that childhood dream of listening to the Champions League song, and it's got such that rhyme about it. That was bloody special, you know. That was pretty special to play in the Champions League, and like I said, to play in the Premier League was something that I grew up with. You know, watching, you know, Harry Kewell and Mark Viduka, and before that, my idols in David Ginola and Dennis Bergkamp and these sort of guys to actually go and play at those clubs and play in those stadiums was my career highlights.
One thing we didn't ask, which probably should have done, what about the best player you've played against?
Defenders wise, we played a friendly game, national team against Brazil. We lost 6-0. I think Thiago Silva didn't probably give me a touch of the ball for 90 minutes. So, he was just a beast. But that would have been about, what was that? That was just before 2010. It would have been 2009. So probably 10 years ago. But yeah, he was phenomenal. So athletic, an absolute machine, strong as. But he was probably the scariest sort of defender that I played up against. And if you go back to the 8-0 absolute squashing that we had at Chelsea, Frank Lampard was so unplayable that day. Those were the two ones that probably scarred me in regards to horrible defeats, but also performance wise where it was like you couldn't even get near the ball because they were so good.
Yeah, I suppose those kind of, you know, like you say, 6-0 and an 8-0, they kind of, for the wrong reasons, stand in your mind. But I suppose at the same time, you're losing against a team that's obviously played really well. So there are, you know, there's going to be performances from the other side that are just going to stick in your mind, isn't there?
That's right. Correct.
A massive thanks for coming on.
No worries.
You know, it's been pleasure. It's been amazing chatting to you. You know, like we've just discussed, you've had a fantastic career. I did say at the time three of the best Dutch managers you played under. I think four of you include obviously with the Australian national team. So you know, you kind of looking back at your career, it's been fantastic. So it's been amazing for us to talk to you. So really appreciate your time.
No worries. It was fun. It was good to chat with you, blokes.
Nice one. Very much appreciated.
And before we go, Brett, what is next for Brett Holman? What are your desires and aims and objectives going forward?
Mate, that's the worst part for footballers. I've actually started my own little football academy program up here on the Sunshine Coast because there's not a lot of football available up here. So I've started my own little academy, but. It's so hard. It's so hard when football's been everything for, you know, a good 20, 25 years. And then all of a sudden it stops. And then it's like, I've still got half, you know, at least a half a life to go. And I don't know what to do anymore. So I'm still finding my feet. It's not easy, but I'm enjoying the coaching side of it and coaching kids. It's fun. But it's a... Finding out what the next phase will be. We're still in the unknown at the moment. So you never know. See what happens.
Yeah, definitely. It's about enjoying that time now, enjoying the relaxation and not having that structure of training every day and spending time with your family.
No more ice baths. That's for sure. So I'm happy about that.
if you do enjoy the coaching side of things, you've got a few contacts to call on to hopefully get you back over maybe in Europe coaching in Holland or in England. Or
you never know if that ends up being the ambition. Then, like you said, we've got some good contacts that I've got, which is great to have. So, yeah, if that ever eventuated, I don't. You know, we can have a crack at that, but who knows? It's very early and I'm not going to speculate.
Yeah, definitely. And that way of life in Australia is quite a
it's too hard. It's too hard to turn away.
Yeah,
it's too exactly. hard. Yeah, I definitely don't miss the European winters anyway. So definitely something I'm not keen on going back to anytime soon. So
poles apart, isn't it, really? Like we said before, and, you know, spending top lot, we're locked in effectively, and the weather's crap. But then, obviously, for you being in Australia, it's completely different with it, you know, weather wise, isn't it?
That's right. No, like I said, we're fortunately enough to be blessed in an area that we are at the moment, and you know, like I said, it's we've got family everywhere. My wife's stuck in Holland, and her parents are stuck in Holland. So, you know, there's enough stories of hardship with what you guys are going through and stuff like that. So, you know, we're thinking of everybody over there, which is easy to say, but we definitely are. So, and hopefully it eventually gets sorted sooner rather than later.
Yep. Well, fingers crossed, it'll get sorted. But a massive thanks, Brett Holman.
No worries.
Look after yourself. Good luck with the coaching. No worries. And stay safe.
Take care. Good luck with the Villa.
Cheers, Brett.
Hopefully they go for Europe. You never know.
Hopefully, fingers crossed. It's been a good start so far. Hopefully, we could push on.
It has been.
So, yeah, definitely. Nice one. Cheers, Brett. We'll speak to you soon.
See you, boys.
Love the Villa, mate. Take care.
Ta-da. Ta-da. Bye.